We all need a shot of encouragement to keep us going.
A New Beginning with Greg Laurie is sure to help in your journey of faith.
Hear it twice daily.
Details at vision.org.au.
A biblical perspective on life, culture, and current events. This is 2020 on Vision.
But first, we're going to get Senator David Fawcett on the line today and discuss this religious discrimination bill, which has the potential to affect every person of faith in Australia. Senator David, are you there?
I am here. Good morning.
Senator, it's good to have you on the show today. I do want to note it's Anzac Day tomorrow, and I looked you up and you did 22 years in the Australian military. So whether or not you did or didn't be deployed overseas and put your life in any sort of danger for Australia, we just want to say well done for your service, for putting your hand up and being willing to defend our country and giving 22 years of your life in the Australian military.
Thank you.
Yeah, but we move on to your current career, which is politics. And just remind our listeners, David, in case they don't know, what is going on with this religious discrimination bill that the federal government is trying to pass?
So one of the commitments of Mr. Albanese when he was the opposition leader was to bring in a bill to provide a religious discrimination bill to protect people of faith. But at the same time, they also made a commitment that they would enhance protections for people of diverse genders, sexuality, etc., in terms of anti-discrimination laws, and removing what have been known as the exemptions that faith-based bodies, so schools, churches, theological colleges, etc., have had for many years, that says that they can operate in accordance with their faith, their beliefs, their doctrines, and that's legal. That the problem with that is that has been seen as an exemption as opposed to a positive right. And so where we're at the moment is that the government asked the Australian Law Reform Commission to do a study to say, how do we allow, in this case, faith-based schools to actually be a faith-based school, but at the same time prevent any discrimination against people who have a protected attribute? And that has caused a lot of contention for a couple of reasons, both the approach that the RLC has taken, but also the fact that the government's response to that report, which is a new piece of legislation, they have not been transparent about it. In fact, they've not tabled it. The people who they have spoken to, and we don't have a list of who they've spoken to, have been sworn to secrecy. I'm not sure if they've actually had to sign a non-disclosure agreement. But it's really hobbled the ability of faith-based communities, of the community more broadly, even of the parliament, to scrutinise what's being proposed by the government. So that's where we're at the moment.
Okay, so let's go back. There's a couple of issues there. The ALRC, you said there were some issues with the way they compiled and presented the report. Just talk us through that. What are those issues?
So look, there's some history to this. When the Morrison government was in government, the then Attorney General asked the ALRC to do a very similar thing, slightly different terms of reference, but to examine how we find the appropriate balance. And Justice Derrington, who was the president at the time, in a speech that she gave, basically outlined the direction they were starting to take. And the key point that she made was that faith-based organisations, such as schools or theological colleges, don't discriminate when they act in accordance with their doctrine and their beliefs. And that's a really important stick in the sand, that was the then ALRC president's assessment of how we interpret human rights law. And she said faith-based schools, organizations don't discriminate if they operate in accordance with their beliefs. What the government then, the current government, gave the ALRC was a different terms of reference, which almost, unless you accept Justice Derrington's definition, are almost impossible to reconcile. And so the report that has come out, and that was led by Justice Rothman, basically says that schools can't, a Christian school can't actually demand that their staff live out the beliefs that they purport to hold or that the school holds to be the way that people should live. And that particularly goes to issues around marriage, sexual conduct, relationships, gender, etc., because those are protected attributes.
So, David, we need to repeat that to emphasise this. So what you're saying is that the current report basically said that a, let's say, a Christian working in a Christian school cannot wholeheartedly or 100% live out their Christian faith in the way they conduct themselves in that Christian school, i.e. the way they hire other staff, the way they teach, what they teach. Is that what you're saying there?
So it's not so much that they can't live out, but the school can't require them to live that out. So the ALRC report is quite internally contradictory, and in fact even Justice Rothman has come out subsequent to the issuing of the report, and he has said, look, schools actually need some positive protections here because the report doesn't really deliver it because we were quite constrained by the government's terms of reference. So even the person who wrote that report says it's a flawed approach. But in effect, what it does is it says to the principal of a school or their hiring department, you can't require that a teacher who comes here both holds to the same faith or is prepared to support, you know, there might be a Anglican who goes to work at a Catholic school, but they're happy to support the sort of ethos and the values of the church. But importantly, they can't require that their actual lifestyle reflects the beliefs. And there's been a number of public commentaries. Professor Patrick Parkinson has given some very good examples of situations in America, for example, where teachers engage in online forums for money that deal with, you know, sexual activities, and yet the school couldn't say, hang on, that's inconsistent with what we believe about the sanctity of marriage and where sex takes place. You can't be a teacher on our staff in a Christian school if you're going to do that, and yet under these proposals, that would be off limits and the school wouldn't be able to take any action against them.
Yeah, and it would just work against the school because Christian parents want to send their children to Christian schools for a reason, don't they? Because of the values and the morals, and also the teachers having at least an agreement to those values and morals, whether or not they're able to live them out 100%. None of us probably can. But yeah, so this is a real dilemma. So what has the government's response been to this report? Have they embraced it? Have they not said anything about it? Like, what's the Albanese government saying about this report?
Well, to date, they've said the report is the report, and because it's the Law Reform Commission, we need to respond to the report. But that approach is undermined by the fact that Justice Rothman has now come out and said, in actual fact, we were so constrained in what we could write that I'm now coming out separately and saying schools actually need positive protections for their right to employ people who share their faith and who will live out that faith in every aspect of their life. So the government is taking at face value the report as opposed to the things that Justice Rothman has subsequently said. And their response is this draft legislation, which very few of us have seen. Michaela Cash, who is a senator from West Australia, she's the Shadow Attorney General. She has been given a copy, but she is not allowed to share that with anyone. So she can talk in general terms about what it contains. But the Senate, for example, we would normally see an exposure draft. Normally when legislation is introduced, there would be a inquiry of a relevant committee, which gives affected stakeholders, so churches, faith-based schools, individuals in the community, the legal profession, the opportunity to scrutinise what the government is proposing and to put forward their comments, so that we can make sure that the legislation is fit for purpose and doesn't have unintended consequences. And at the moment, the government is not proposing to do any of that, which is completely at odds with normal practice, and it's not transparent at all. So they are responding as though the ALRC report is something that they must implement, and they're not telling us how they're planning to do it.
Yeah, so, I mean, and I'm guessing that, you know, the opposition has asked this question to the government. Why? And is there any response to that question? Why?
Look, the only comments that have come out from the Attorney General have been around the fact that they don't want a divisive debate in the community. But this is a very sensitive issue, and it goes to the fact that there are many people in our society today who are not people of faith, and they see faith as just something which is an optional extra, if you like, whereas somebody's gender identity or sexual preferences, etc., they say that's part of who they are, so we must protect that over something that is sort of an optional extra for people. Whereas those who have a faith recognise that it's very central, it's core to your being, it directly impacts how you live and your values, and so it's not something you can just lay down or discard. And that's why the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and all the subsequent measures such as the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which is sort of the implementation of those rights, make it very clear that all of these rights, the rights to have a faith, the rights to be free from discrimination, the right to speak freely, the right to assemble and associate with people who you wish to, all of those are equal, and you can't just dismiss three or four of them to uphold one. And I think Professor Parkinson makes a very useful point here in that he says rather than have exemptions to an anti-discrimination law, we should actually be emphasising the fact that people have the right to associate. And so if people with parents of faith want to come together and have a school where their children are educated to a high standard of academic, but also within a worldview that supports their faith, their doctrine, then they have the right to associate together to teach those things. And so if you see it through the lens of that's a positive right for them to associate, then it's not discrimination. It's just saying those who share this belief are welcome to come and join us here. And if you don't share this belief, that's fine. There's other schools where you can either go and teach or you can send your students.
Yeah, which is really a definition of freedom, isn't it? That everyone in that scenario is free to make their own choices. And I think you've really hit the nail on the head there. I think a lot of modern Australians and many in the media and in politics see faith as, like you said, an optional extra or something weird you do on Sunday or a few weird ideas you've got or beliefs. And to this, what's the cliche a lot of people say, oh, you talk to that friend in the sky or whatever it is, and they don't understand, do they, that faith is so central to a Christian's life, their work, their family, their sense of identity. It's everything. And I think that's what they're not seeing. And it kind of brings me on to the next topic that we want to quickly cover, which is the Israel-Hamas war. It feels to me, David, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, that a lot of people in Australia, again, do not really understand what's going on in the Israel-Hamas war or in Gaza right now, because they're not looking at it through the lens of that there's actually a faith behind this. There's a belief system behind this. This is not just about real estate or seeking revenge, is it? There's something deeper going on here, which maybe people in Australia don't quite grasp.
Yeah, look, I will come to that. I just want to make one final comment, if I can, around how society sees faith. The whole concept of the value of an individual, the concept of human rights for the individual, the separation of church and state, if you look back through history and you look at contemporary writers such as Larry Seidenthoff, who wrote a book called Inventing the Individual, The Origins of Western Liberalism, they detail how many of the things we value in free democracies such as Australia actually have their roots in the Christian worldview.
Yeah,
and it's led to things like, you know, Wilberforce getting rid of slavery, Henri Dunant, who founded the Red Cross. It was his faith seeing wounded soldiers just left to die on the battlefield of Solferino.
Yeah,
Mary MacKillop here in Australia. Many of the things we value as society actually come from the Judeo-Christian worldview, and I think it's really important that we help re-educate our society that the church is not something just to be tolerated, but it's actually something to be celebrated, because faith has actually led to many of the really positive aspects of our community.
Well said, David. Well said. Can't agree with you more. So, well, let's quickly move on
to Israel.
Yeah, let's move on to the Israel-Hamas war. What? Yeah, I mean, you're obviously in the government. You're interacting with people in the government. How do you think the Australian government is responding to the Israel-Hamas war?
So I'm in the parliament. I'm actually in the opposition. So I'm a member of the Liberal Party. So I'm in the opposition rather than the government. But look, the Middle East is complex, has been for many years. But this particular incident has really highlighted the fact that many in the West are not well-versed in the history, nor are they well-versed in the ideologies behind different groups. And Hamas is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, who are a terrorist organization who are committed in their charter to the destruction of Israel and the Jewish people. And in fact, after the 7th of October attacks, they have come out publicly and said that they will repeat that as soon as they have the opportunity, as often as they can, until Israel no longer exists.
Yeah.
So that's what we're dealing with here.
And I just want to interrupt you there. So yeah, and that means a two-state solution will not satisfy Hamas, will it? They won't stop at a two-state solution. That's not going to make them lay down their arms and say, "Oh, look at this. We've achieved our aims now. We can all just relax and go back to normal life."
Correct. So they are not a partner for peace. They're not a partner that can actually lead to a positive future. And so what's important is that we, rather than look at what Israel has done, which is a legitimate self-defense, and the death toll and the impact on community is dreadful, and there's no way to sugarcoat that. But the question has to be asked, are their actions illegal? And the answer is no. Are their actions unusual? And if we look back through even recent history, the answer is actually no. And that what I would point people to is the case study that the International Committee of the Red Cross have done into international humanitarian law, where they looked at the battle for Mosul, where the world was called by the United Nations. The Security Council literally said, everyone who is able should participate to ensure the destruction of ISIS, that terrorist group.
Yeah.
And this was particularly after that attack, the Yazidi people. And there was massive destruction in Mosul because ISIS used civilians as human shields. And the only way to destroy ISIS was to attack their command centers, the place that they were fighting from. But when ISIS had a whole bunch of civilians there, inevitably civilians were killed. And yet nobody called for a ceasefire. Nobody said that the Jordanians, the Americans, all the other countries, including Australia, who were involved in that, were committing war crimes. They said, look, be as careful as you can, but get on, defeat ISIS. And in fact, Amnesty International made the point in one of the documents referenced in this case study that the fact that there were so many civilian casualties, actually the blame rested with ISIS, not with the coalition. And so if you look at the Israeli approach from a purely military and humanitarian law perspective, they've had this battle before. They actually battled ISIS nearly a decade ago, Hamas nearly a decade ago. And in the aftermath of that, there was an international senior leadership group, including my former colleague, Senator Jim Molan, the late Jim Molan, who had a very distinguished career in the Australian military. And the report of this group, and I've spoken to Jim while he was with us in detail about this, was that the Israelis apply international humanitarian law to a standard at least as good, if not higher, than countries such as the US, the UK, Australia, and other Western nations. And so there's a lot of narrative and propaganda saying that, you know, this is awful, and yes, the outcomes on the ground are awful, but Israel is legitimately seeking to destroy a terrorist group that is wanting to wipe Israel off the map. And the fact that there are so many civilian casualties is not for want of trying by the approach Israel takes. They're not perfect and mistakes happen, and we've seen that just for those seven humanitarian workers. But Israel's approach has been legitimate. And if we're going to call for them to stop actions against Hamas, then just like the world joined together to destroy ISIS, we need to actually be stepping forward and saying we will step in to ensure that Hamas no longer remains in power. So it's a very convoluted situation. People don't understand the background, but Hamas is not a partner for peace, and the only way that region will have peace, the only way the Palestinian people will have a future with prosperity, is for Hamas to be removed, so that we can build on things like the Abraham Accords, where an increasing number of nations in the Middle East have normalized their relationships with Israel and said, we can work together for a better future.
Yeah, well said, David. And like you said, it's sad that we have political leaders in Australia today saying things and making statements which are so ignorant because, like you said, mistakes happen. I mean, a couple of Israeli hostages were killed by their own soldiers a couple of months ago trying to escape from Hamas. It was a mistake. Mistakes happen. Ron Barassi, the famous AFL player in Victoria, his dad was killed in World War II, one of the first Australians to die, not by a German, by an Australian soldier cleaning his rifle. Like, mistakes happen, it's sad. But it's sad, like you said, that people are trying to label Israel as the bad guys here when all they're trying to do is defend their territory and protect their citizens. But David Fawcett, the federal senator from South Australia, we really want to thank you for joining us on 2020 today and giving us such a detailed and comprehensive analysis there of that ALRC report and also the Israel-Hamas war. And looking forward to speaking with you next time, David.
Thank you very much. Can I just encourage your listeners to put pen to paper? Emails are fine, but so few people write letters anymore that they actually have a great impact. So put pen to paper. If you're concerned about that, write to your local MP, write to the Prime Minister, and highlight why faith is important and why we need faith-based schools to be able to freely associate and be true to their values.
Thank you, David.
Cheers.
Thanks for taking time to listen to this audio on demand from Vision Christian Media. To find out more about us, go to vision.org.au.